obtain additional copies, receive a free catalog of AA and Al-Anon talks, or to find out about our tape and CD of the Month Club, call Encore Audio Archives at 1-800-878-1308 or visit our website at www.12steptapes.com.
Well, it's about time people in AA know who the hell I am. After all these years, my name's Mike Finnegan, I'm an alcoholic. By the grace of the power I found through the 12 steps and love and support of this wonderful fellowship that I'm a member of, I haven't found it necessary to take a drink or any alcohol enhancers since July 19th, 1986, and for that I'm very grateful. You can say hi, Mike. God damn it, he done told you who I am. Pay attention. That's amazing when I hear that in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I've actually spoken at meetings before and mentioned the fact that, you know, when you're talking about your life, sometimes what you do might come into it, especially if you spend your life in upholstered sewers getting your head toe up tough for a living. But, and they always say, sometimes there's always a few people that go, hey, man, who did you play with? And I always say, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. And that's absolutely the truth. It doesn't matter. In here, I'm just another drunk. And for the people that are new in Alcoholics Anonymous, I'm not an AA speaker. There's a couple of them here. There's a couple people here that are AA speakers, but they're also members. I'm just a member. And if you stay here, you can become one too. In fact, if you're here, you're a member, if you say you are. According to the way I read it, member is as high as you can get. If, I guess I could have phrased that a little better, but... you know, that's the top of the line. Although there's a few people that I've met in AA that think they maybe might be in charge of a few more things. And... you know, that, I love that, though. I love it, that, you know, the vast equality in Alcoholics Anonymous. I was sitting out front this morning, or actually this afternoon, and I saw a bride and her bridesmaids or maid of honor and a photographer out in front taking pictures. And I first thought I had was maybe, you know, the front of the hotel, is that the best spot? And then I thought, well, the drunks are all everywhere else, so... You know, and I thought how thrilling it must be for her to have her wedding party here at this hotel on this weekend. You know, other brides may forget some of those moments, but she won't forget this. Reminds me of the first time I went to a convention. I only had about, I don't know, 4 or 5 months of sobriety. I can't remember for sure, but... I know I didn't have a year, and I went to the San Fernando Valley AA convention, and it was blowing my mind, you know, like all this mad moving, and everybody's sober, and I was still pretty shaky. And I walked in, and the people in front of me were actually going to check into the hotel. At least that was their intention. And I heard the woman say to the desk clerk, who are all these people? And the desk clerk said, well, it's the San Fernando Valley Alcoholics Anonymous convention. And she went, you mean all of these people are alcoholics? And I said, well, some of them are just straight up addicts. You know, so you don't not you ain't got nothing to worry about. Everything's all right. And they just looked at me, but that was, you know, unforgettable for me. And for once, I was like, yeah, I guess my case is different. You know, I'm with these people, and you're not. I want to thank Dave and Mike and the committee. I don't know if the committee knew what they were getting, but Dave B. certainly and Mike Y. for inviting me to share with you tonight. It's always an honor to be asked to participate in a meeting of AA. And I'm certainly glad to be here. I have so many friends that live down here. I haven't been to this roundup in about 10 years. I'm usually on the road this time of year. And, you know, that's a good thing. You know, being employed is always good. You know, so sober alcoholics with a job, that's what we like. You know, in fact, one of my good friends always, whenever he shares, he always winds up his share with, God bless you and get a job. You know, and anyway, I want to thank them, and I want to welcome all the people that are here for the first time, and all our new friends that might be here with us, as I said, and anybody that's celebrating any anniversaries or, you know, months of sobriety or whatever, or, you know, I'm glad for you, and I'm glad to be part of you this day with you. I should tell you a little bit about where I come from. Johnny told you a little bit about it. He didn't have to tell you the day I was born and the year. You know, I'm getting to be kind of like my wife on that matter. You know, she's getting younger every year. She's a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous, too, Candy F. And, but, you know, and she's rigorously honest about everything but her age. In fact, our daughter was recently with a friend of Candy's who, that she grew up with. She's from Wichita, Kansas. And this girl and her have been friends ever since they were in kindergarten. They're the same age. And my daughter was with this woman someplace and mentioned that it was my wife's birthday. And my daughter said to this woman, and you're only a couple years older than her, right? And this woman said, God damn. No, oh no, we're the same age. And Bridget said to her, hey, you don't have to lie, Joanne, it's okay. You know, and that became a big deal, and my wife has not told the truth to my daughter about that yet. The woman is really upset. Why did you tell your daughter? She said, well, you know, that's how old I am now. That's all there is to it. You know, that's the number I'm taking, and I'm sticking to it. Anyway, I grew up in Troy, Ohio. It's a little town, about 12,000 people. Neither one of my parents were alcoholic. I didn't have that good on-site alcoholic example like you guys, or some of you anyway. I heard, you know, after I'd been sober a while, I started thinking, what the hell's my excuse, you know? I'm an alcoholic. Neither one of my parents drank. My name's Finnegan, so I did have some... There's a few people, and Kelly was my mother's family, and there's a few drunks sprinkled around the family tree. But nobody right there on site, you know. So I didn't have any of that to point to, like somebody that I'm never going to be like, that I got to be like, you know, those guys. And we were loved, didn't have much, but we had enough. And I'll cut to the chase right now as far as, you know, my childhood was perfectly normal little town. I was the oldest of three boys, and as Johnny mentioned, I was, by the time I was a senior in high school, I'll tell you this, I was the kind of guy that always wanted to excel for whatever reason. You know, this was through inventory, the things that we do in AA, the 12 steps, got me into a little bit of self-examination. I had the interior life of a fly. Before I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, there was no examination. There was self-centeredness, but no self-examination. No thoughts of, like, why did I do that? Why did I say that? You know, I was just like, operating on self all the way. And that was okay with me, and it was working. And I needed a drink probably by the time I was, you know, 5 or 6 years old, but I didn't have my first drink till I was 18. And I came out of high school or was about to graduate and was being pursued by all these colleges to play basketball because I was a pretty good athlete. And I made pretty good grades because I had to do well in everything that I did so you wouldn't know who I was, or at least who I thought I was, because who I thought I was not much. And so it was important that I did well. And so I was trying to decide where to go. I decided to go to the University of Kansas because they had a great basketball program. And I also, it was really important for me to get as far away from Troy, Ohio as I could get, because I figured the further away I got, the more like I was supposed to feel I would feel. I'm 18 years old. I haven't had a drink yet. My first year in college, or I should say my first couple of weeks, I was living in a jock dorm. Now, some of you may not know what that is, and that's a good thing that you don't know. But a jock dorm is where athletes live, scholarship athletes, not tennis players, not golfers, not volleyball players, man, football and basketball players. Those are the dumbbells that live in a jock dorm, right? The testosterone is leaking out of the walls. They're manly men. No place for a guy that doesn't think much of himself. A coward is what I really thought. You know, I fit in there like spats at an Iowa picnic, but I didn't tell him. You know, I didn't let him know. It's not the kind of place with all those manly men that a rather insecure guy, sensitive person like me, would have said to his roommate late one evening, "Bill, may I share something with you? I'm feeling kind of vulnerable." That's not the conversation you have at a jock dorm. Ever. But these guys, a couple of them asked me if I wanted to go drinking with them, and I had never had a drink, because if you want to excel in athletics and you're a, you know, semi-squared up guy trying to fit in and get by, you don't drink, because you're not supposed to. Athletes don't drink, you know, like hell. I was a sheltered young man. But I was glad to be invited anywhere. I didn't know anybody, so they took me to a grown-up bar in Kansas City. Not in Lawrence, Kansas. That's 20 miles away. That's where the University of Kansas was. But 20 miles down the road to Kansas City, that's a jumping town. At least it was still a jumping town in 1963. You know, that's a great music town. It's got a tremendous music history. Some of the greatest American jazz and rhythm and blues music and country music comes out of Kansas City. And that was another attraction for me. But anyway, they took me to a grown-up bar in Kansas City with grown-up men and women, no college kids, and they seemed to know their way around. They were all juniors and seniors, and four or five of these guys. They take the rookie out to drink, and I'd never ordered a drink in my life, and they ordered a beer and a shot, so I ordered a beer and a shot. And I knew what alcohol was supposed to do, and I waited for it to start doing it. You know, I was the kind of guy, and I've talked about this before, because I remember now that I've been sober a little while, you know, if I walked into a room full of people, like a bar, let alone a room like this where there's a lot of people all looking at me, normally that would make me feel good. But back then it wouldn't. I didn't like people looking at me, and if I walked into a room full of people that I didn't know, what I saw in the eyes of those people was a look that said, "What's that guy doing here?" That's what I saw. That was my perception. After I had a few beers and shots, I didn't see that look anymore. What I saw in the eyes of the people in that bar that night in Kansas City that I had my first alcohol experience was a look of acceptance and love. And that was just the men. And in the eyes of the women, what I saw was a look of pure hunger. And naturally, I found my first drinking experience very good. And I had a wonderful time that evening because of all those hungry women. And in fact, one of them, I think, if I recall, we got to share a little later, and I'm convinced that I helped her. She definitely helped me. But, you know, the main thing is that the way I responded to the drug alcohol that night, I never forgot it, because that became my answer. And when I was talking about this to a couple of people the last couple of days about how when you get it all peeled back, it's not just alcohol, it's control. That's my problem. And we were discussing like that section in the Big Book where it talks about the actor who wants to control. He wants to arrange the lights and the ballet and the scenery. If only his arrangements would stay put, life would be wonderful. I remember when my sponsor had me read that, and he said, "Do you recognize that guy?" And I said, "Yeah, I know a lot of some bitches like that." I said, I sure as hell do recognize him. I know him. And later on, after I'd been sober a little longer, I recognized him a little better. And that's exactly what my drinking was about. That evening revealed to me the power for me to control the way I experience life. And I didn't forget that. And alcohol became my go-to. Well, naturally, later on, I dropped out of school about a year and a half after I'd been there to go on the road with the band. I started playing music, and I became infected with being a musician, and I'm still a musician 50 years later. Turns out that was one good choice I made. Well, I made two. I made the right choice of a career, and I made the right choice in a woman. Still married to the same woman 44 years later. And I'd like to say that was without a drink, but, you know, hell, even a blind pig finds an acorn once in a while. But anyway, control is the answer. And that's the thing that I got from alcohol. That was what made it so important to me. I could control how I experienced life, and I proceeded to do that. And, of course, being a musician and all these guys that I started traveling with were all guys that had been in the business quite a bit longer. I was very young. And we were traveling everywhere, all over the country, playing in upholstered tours, like I said, and you know, it's Tulsa this week for a couple of weeks, and then it's Dallas for a couple of weeks, and then it's, you know, in Birmingham, Alabama, and then it's Philadelphia, and then it's, you know, like East Amboy, New Jersey, at Vinny's Black and Blue Room or someplace like that. But it's show business, ladies and gentlemen, and it's exciting. Every night, Saturday night, and every day is Sunday, don't you know? You know, that was my life. And when you're a young guy and you can drink all night and sleep part of the day, you bounce back quick and you feel good and everything's all right and everything's melody and fine. You know, and that was, and with that, my friend alcohol, of course, these guys were introducing me to some of those alcohol enhancers I mentioned. And, you know, they were quite generous, introduced me to, you know, cocaine and you know, Nemitol and Secanol. These are old time drugs, and Tuinol and anything at all, you know. And marijuana and all kinds of uppers and downers and sideways and, you know, all them things, you know. And like, and I was happy to try them all out. I tried the drug heroin, didn't like it, got all sick, felt like I had the flu. But that didn't stop me from trying it one more time just to make sure that I just didn't get a bad batch, you know. And at no time did I think I had a problem, and I really didn't have a problem at that time. I was just creeping around the edges of a problem. I was certainly had learned, and every time I'm into one of these new places like New York City or any place that I wind up being with these guys, and a young guy, 20 years old at that time, 19, 20, 21 years old, you know, I'm scared. The old walk into a room and what I see in the eyes of the people is, what's that guy doing here? Man, when you put that on stage and have to perform for these unfriendly people, some of them are using the drug alcohol to control the way they experience life. You know, some of them aren't doing a very good job of it. And they're not that nice. So, but alcohol was always there for me. And I could always go to that bar just before we started playing and stand there. And I decided Jack Daniels was a drink I liked because it was good. And it wasn't just, you know, that, it wasn't just that, you know, bar whiskey, man. It was like Jack Daniels, you know, something fitting for a man of my stature. Yeah, the stature I, you know, wanted to have or something. Yeah, that stuff, you know. And I'd have a couple of shots of Jack Daniels. And after I'd had two or three, and I never got myself so tore up I was drunk on the job, but I just wanted to get nice, you know. As a friend of mine used to say, I just wanted to step out easy, you know. And, you know, take it easy. Slow down. And I'd have a few shots of whiskey, and I'd look, and I wasn't afraid anymore. Look in that mirror behind the bar and just say, you good-looking son of a bitch. What are you afraid of? Man, they gonna love you. And that's what alcohol did for me. It doesn't do that for everybody because I've asked around. You know, you talk to a regular civilian and say, has alcohol ever made you feel like you were real good looking and that people were going to love you? And they always say, no. I've told this story before. I had a neighbor right after I sobered up that he was having trouble with his wife. And he asked me for some advice, because after I'd been sober in AA for a while, he started thinking I was a human. And, you know, the squealing tires had stopped and the broken glass and the cursing and all that other stuff that goes on between midnight and 6 a.m. And, you know, anyway, he confided in me some of the problems. And I told him, I said, you know, your wife knows that you want to make good. And you know she wants to make good. Patience, tolerance, and love are the watchwords. Show her these things in yourself, and they will be reflected back to you. If you both show a willingness to remedy your own defects, there will be little need to criticize each other. And he went, wow. He said, man, that's deep. He goes, where'd you learn that? And I said, I heard that in Alcoholics Anonymous. It's in our book. It's in the chapter, The Wives. I said, I always just change the pronoun around so it applies to me. And he goes, man, that's some good shit. He goes, little need to criticize each other. He goes, you know, maybe I should go to a meeting. And I said, well, you're going to have to drink. And I said, you can't just go in there, you know, like, looking for the wisdom on the cheap. I said, you're going to have to make some sacrifices, man. And he said, I got drunk once. I said, that ain't going to do it. What happened? He goes, well, I got drunk. And he said, and he had a big yard. And he said, I was living here. And he said, I lost my keys out here somewhere. And then I threw up. And I couldn't find my keys, and I passed out, and that's the last time I ever did that. And I said, well, shit, man, you can't get anywhere like that. I said, you're going to have to do something better than that if you want to come with us, man. I said, you're a quitter, really. You ain't got what it takes. If you want to be a member of AA, you got to be a man of vision. You know, you got to be willing to do whatever it takes. You got to have a goal and be willing to do whatever it takes to get there. And you don't have it. So you're going to have to get your AA wisdom through me. Unless you want to start drinking right. You know, and if you don't want to do that, then I'm sorry. He understood. But he's one of the guys that I asked about controlling and enjoying, and those people just don't have the same kind of problem we do. But I was thinking about this, since this is a musician's meeting, I usually don't talk about my sobriety, how it applies to my work, you know, when I'm just sharing at a meeting, because it doesn't mean a damn thing. You know, I'm a big believer in, like I said, on the great leveler. Alcohol is a great leveler, and AA will keep us level. You know, like, nobody gives a damn what anybody does. And I find a point of pride. I sponsor guys that don't know what I do, you know, and some of them do after a couple of years, but it's not something that is important to our discussions. And, but I remember when I first sobered up, I had this idea that my case was different because I work with a lot of people get high, right? That's part of my job. Don't you know? That's what I thought. You know, it's not the same. You know, I've been around these people. Half the people I work with are high as a Georgia pine most of the day. You know, at least it was that way back in those days. You know, I'm talking about in the mid-80s, that was still kind of the culture of my business. I mean, I'd signed record deals and stuff in offices of big major record labels where people like broke out the blow, you know. Congratulations, let's get loaded. You know, I mean, the executives, not just the musicians, everybody's getting the head toe up. You know, it was part of that. You know, so I had this idea. You know, of course, I also had the idea that everybody drank like me. You know, which later turned out to be false once I was sober long enough to look around and notice, nope, they're not doing it like me. You know, but I'll tell you a story that helped me disabuse myself of the notion that my case was a little different. I didn't say it was a lot different. That's not what I thought. I thought it was just a little different, you know. And there was a guy at this meeting I used to go to every morning the first 7 or 8 years I was sober. I used to go to this meeting in a place called Chandler Lodge up in the valley. It's a street-level detox and sober living. And they have meetings in there. It's been there a long time. And I used to love going in there. There'd be fights in there. You know, in my early sobriety, I thought that was great. Well, that's my kind of place, you know. Not all this politeness, people throwing chairs every once in a while, you know. One time a woman was in there throwing the donuts at her ex-husband, saying, "This is my meeting. Go to your own fucking meeting. It's nothing. Get out of here." You know, that's the kind of action I like, you know. It makes you feel at home, you know. And, but there was a guy in there, the first, you know, I was sober like 6-7 months or something, and I'd been there every morning. I used to wake up at 4 a.m. in my early sobriety sometimes going, "I got to get to a meeting," you know, because I didn't trust myself just to be at home. You know, like, I didn't need anybody to tell me that an alcoholic alone is in bad company, you know. Before you guys told me that, I knew that, you know, because I had my track record in front of me. Well, what will Finnegan do? He's going to get drunk. That's what he does. You know, so anyway, I'm at this meeting, and this guy was always new. There was this fella that used to stand up new every couple of weeks. He'd, you know, he'd stand up, not, well, he'd be new, and then he'd stay sober for a month or so, and then he'd stand up new again. He'd stay sober. But that went on. I saw him stand up new a lot of times, and he didn't ever say much, and one day he decided, he shared with us, and he said, "You know, I know a lot of you people wonder what my trouble is, and how come I have to keep standing up new, and why I can't stay sober. And I know you want to know why, you know," and he said, "And I'll tell you why." He says, "It's because of pressure." He said, "I'm under a lot of pressure." He said, "I got a job that you wouldn't understand." He said, "The kind of work I do is so full of pressure that I can't stay sober." And I'm thinking, air traffic controller. You know? And I'm thinking, general manager of the universe. No, that's my job. What can it be? So after the meeting, I went up to him and I said, "Man, I'm sorry you're having so much trouble." I said, "What kind of work do you do?" And he said, "I'm an upholsterer."
To obtain additional copies, receive a free catalog of AA and Al-Anon talks, or to find out about our tape and CD of the month club, call Encore Audio Archives at 1-800-878-1308 or visit our website at www.12steptapes.com.
That's when I knew my case wasn't different. That's when I really knew it. I went, "Well, you know, I'm crazier than hell, but I ain't that crazy. I'm never going to blame, you know." And, of course, by that time, I'd learned that, you know, part of my job as a sober man was to relieve everybody else of the responsibility for my happiness, which is a big gig, you know, because I spent so many years, whenever I was uncomfortable, I'd spent years, like, just rounding up the usual suspects to find out who's screwing up my life. You know, I mean, it ain't me. You know, it's got to be one of a half a dozen people or possibly some of their friends. but it's not my fault, you know. And I, that's one of the first things I learned in AA was, you know, before I even got to step 10, I, you know, somebody, my sponsor probably said, you know, it's not their fault anymore, man. You know, if you're uncomfortable, you're going to have to look at you. And I apologize for that, but that's all, that's what we got, you know. And I remember in my early days of sobriety, the first time I went on the road after I got sober, I had 45 days of sobriety. And the reason I'm talking about this is they're calling this a musician's meeting, so I'll tell you a little bit about that, my sober experience in that life. And I was terrified because I had not played entirely sober or made, taken a trip entirely sober in over 20 years. And I didn't know if I could do it. And but I needed money, and I only had one skill, and I'm not that good at that, you know, and got a few people fooled, but I talked to my sponsor about it, and he said, well, you're going to have to support your family. It's the only thing you know how to do. And he goes, God's either solved your problem or he hadn't. And I guess we better find out whether or not that's the case. And I said, well, all right. And he said, all you got to do is call me every day like you've been doing. You're going to read your book. You're going to go to meetings when you can. And you're going to say your prayers. If you ain't praying, you ain't staying. And I said, man, that guy is chilly. You know, God's going to find out if God solved my problem. Man, I don't think God solved any problem for me. That was my experience. I'll talk about that later if I got time. But, I mean, I'm a recovering Catholic along with everything else. And you know, not to put down on organized religion or anything else. It's just my own experience. And anyway, I went out there, and I just didn't think I'd be able to stay sober because the guys I was going on the road with were all toe up. Like I said, every one of them was like fried day in and day out. And I finally learned that Alcoholics Anonymous had solved my problem. I found that out real early in my sobriety because the truth of the matter was, despite Finnegan's track record as a drunk, what I realized after I took myself out there and was away from the comfort of all the meetings that I went to every day, and I was going to two or three of them a day in those the first couple of years of my sobriety, but when I went out with just not even 2 months of sobriety on the road, it was so scary to me. But what I found out was that I wanted to stay sober more than I wanted anything in the world. And that was really a discovery that I didn't realize was true. You know, I'd come into AA because I needed to, and it was time. You know, my wife was the first one in our family that really had the sack to do something. You know, she's a sober member of AA, but she was the first one to go do something about her alcoholism. You know, and after I saw it working for her, I decided maybe I'd get some of that too. But I didn't realize the depth of my desire to stop drinking until I went on the road that first time. And I just did what I was told. You know, I went to meetings everywhere. I've been to meetings in every state in this country, and I've been to meetings in probably 15 or 20 countries, at least 15. And somebody, I went to the Al-Anon luncheon last night, or yesterday afternoon, they were talking about, she was, Lorraine, was it? Bonnie, excuse me. Hell, I had to remember that name. I'm glad she's not here. You know what? She's one of, she wouldn't mind me telling you she's been sober over 25 years. And loving it a lot, you know. But I heard her talking about moving away, you know, from Southern California and you know, somebody mentioned to her they got a meeting in Chicago. It's like, we don't care how you do it in Southern California or something like that. You know, it's just too damn bad about them, you know. Because what we got in Southern California is better AA than any place else. I mean, you know, that's just my opinion. But my opinion means a lot to me. You know, I've been to meetings where I really have. I mean, I accept whatever's going on anywhere. I remember I was in New York City one time at a meeting, and they said, are there any visitors from outside of town? And I said, yeah, Mike from Los Angeles. And he goes, oh, L.A., huh? Everything's a miracle. He goes, yeah, where they applaud everything, right? And, well, I'm an alcoholic, man. You scratch me deep enough, you're going to find one. And I said, well, if you say something worth a shit, maybe they'd applaud you. I said, we're pretty happy with God's work out there, buddy. And this friend of mine that was sober in AA went, wow, that's some California sobriety, huh? You know. Anyway, like I said, I've been all over the world. I've been in 40 countries, been to meetings in so many of them, in every state, and we got the best AA there is. And that's just all there is to it, you know. And I'm so grateful that I was able to get my AA here. And as I said, like traveling around and being on the road so many times and having the opportunity to visit AA meetings. And don't misunderstand me. I'm always grateful whenever I find one and I have the time to get to one and be with people that 9 times out of 10 are going to welcome me. There's only been a few times when I haven't been welcomed, you know, and at least up to the standards I expect, you know. And I went in a men's meeting one time. There's like 12 guys sitting in a circle, no other chairs. And I got there, and I was about 5 minutes late because it was outside of Pittsburgh someplace, and took a cab out there. And I said, is there another chair? And they said, no. So I just sat on the floor, and it didn't hurt their feelings at all. You know, but I didn't get drunk over it. I did have to write about it a little bit, but I was able to forgive those sons of bitches. And, you know, the usual prayer, God, please make sure these guys get everything they got coming to them. You know, it's a start, you know. But I'll tell you, to go on about my career, like how my AA life changed the rest of my life, and what I found out because of that experience so early in my sobriety was that I could never allow my life or the life AA was giving me to get in the way of my AA life. And it has to be number one for me, because it's done so much for me. And it's done so much for my family. Our children were 7 and 4 when I got sober and my wife was sober. And, you know, they never had to look at us drunk again. And I don't ever want to forget what my children used to look like that last, you know, a few months that I was drinking, and I'd disappear for weeks at a time, or not weeks, but days at a time. I'd disappear for weeks at a time, supposed to be working, but, you know, working, yeah, but what else? And, you know, the eyes of the children of an alcoholic, that they look at you when you do show up and they've got that look, those little children, you know, in their eyes, because they got to know who's coming in. You know, is it Mr. Wonderful with a new bicycle? Or is it that scary guy? You know, and they've got to know, and they want to get their hearts out of their throats. And I remember what that looks like. I never want to see that again. Our children are grown and gone now, but we never did have to see that again, thanks to Alcoholics Anonymous. And they got to grow up in a home where if somebody said something unkind and maybe slammed the door as they went stomping out of the room, they got a chance to come back in, stomp back in, and say maybe they hadn't acted right. And they were sorry, I'm going to try to do better. And in a place where when we had dinner and we all sat down and ate together and spent time together, that people told the truth about themselves and about their lives. And that's something I learned here and something my wife learned here. And our children learned that too, because they got to see us doing it. Our children, as I said, are grown and gone. My son's Kelly. My daughter's Bridget. My daughter's a nurse. That's good if you're a musician. Hell, that's good if you're anything. You know, I told her, I said, we can use a nurse, you know. But, you know, she likes helping people. I think she learned that from the life that we were living, that we learned in AA. But she's also just a good woman, you know. She's just good down deep, and I think we might have helped nurture that a little bit because of living by the 12 steps. Not doing it perfect, but trying, doing the best we could. And also, part of that was that they learned was like we didn't expect them to be perfect, and if somebody made a mistake, we knew they, you know, could maybe try again and do a little better. And admitting all the time, you know, the mantra, you know, fall down six times, get up seven, you know, and understanding progress, not perfection, and really understanding that, you know, perfectionism is one of my biggest defects of character, and I got a few of them. And I used to think perfectionism was good because I knew you wanted it perfect, you know. And later on, I found out that my perfectionism made my family uncomfortable. You know, that's not where that goes. Put that where it belongs. It's a magazine. You know, that's how I found out about my obsessive need to control and enjoy other people. Not just alcohol. And understand that, you know, as Johnny mentioned, like letting go of attachments and letting go of my way. I had a way, you know. I've got lots of ways. I had ways before I came to AA, and after I've been sober in AA, I'm still discovering my ways. And my way is a good way. You know, and I have to tell you that sometimes, because your way is no good. I remember I sponsored guys for probably 6 or 7 years. The first guy I ever sponsored, I told Johnny and Mary yesterday, I had about 11 months, and this guy asked me to be a sponsor. And I went to my sponsor and said, this guy wants me to be a sponsor. What do you think? And he goes, well, if he's sick enough to ask you, I don't think you can hurt him. So pretty soon, within a few years, I sponsored a whole bunch of guys. And, you know, for a little while, that made me feel kind of important till I realized that my pride was like that I know a lot of people in Alcoholics Anonymous. Nice going. If that was your goal, you're doing good. That's what I always tell guys. We've seen your plan. You're in a basement. It's Wednesday. Nice going. That's a great plan you got, buddy. But anyway, I had a way, you know, after I'd sponsored a few guys for a few years, and I had a way, you know, like here's the way I do it. And what I finally figured out that was that my way didn't work with some people. And that was their fault. Well, this guy, he just doesn't want it, you know. Just can't hear me. And at some point, my sponsor said, you know, maybe you should try telling him something different in a different way. You know, forget about your way. Try something else. Your job is to carry the message of Alcoholics Anonymous. Your job isn't to do it your way. You know, you'd maybe have more success if you'd be a little bit more, you know, a little looser. Give up on your old ideas. You've got some old ideas that are only a couple years old. You know, but you're loving them just like the ones you had before you came here. And that was true, you know. I found out that a pat on the back and a kick in the ass are only 6 inches apart, you know. And I found out that some guys need that, one or the other. Some guys don't need either one, you know. But what I do know is that the life that I have, I've just been up here rambling. Since this is a musician's meeting, I thought brilliantly, well, I'll give a little different kind of talk tonight. Because I'm not attached to my way, you know. So I thought I'd take a little shot and talk about some other things that I usually don't talk about, along with what I always talk about, which is the life that I've been given here, and about the fact that I learned here that, you know, the most, probably the biggest thing of all, besides how to be a father and how to be a man and how to be a husband and how to be a friend and how to be a sponsor, those things all matter. And I found out that the big lessons are still true. Alcoholics Anonymous doesn't have a corner on principles. You know, those things all existed long before we came along. But that's the reason this deal works. You know, principles aren't laws. Laws can be changed, you know, but principles are everlasting truths. And that's why this thing works. You know, I know that love and service, or what Dr. Bob said, this thing boils down to love and service when you finally boil it all down. And if I love my friends and serve my friends, they will love me. And if I love and serve my community will love and serve me. And if I love and serve only my money, then I will have only my money. And if I love and serve only myself, then I will have only myself. So there's no more winning for me. There's no more getting or acquiring or getting ahead and all those things that used to mean so much to me. They don't matter as much anymore. What matters to me is love and service. You know, because greed is misery, and misery means not knowing the meaning of enough. You know, acquiring more, having more, the vision that a spirituality that I learned in Alcoholics Anonymous knows what enough is and knows that what I have is much more than I could have ever wanted for myself. And I got it all from drunks and Alcoholics Anonymous. Thank you.
Enjoyed this recording. To obtain additional copies, receive a free catalog of AA and Al-Anon talks, or to find out about our tape and CD of the month club, call Encore Audio Archives at 1-800-878-1308 or visit our website at www.12steptapes.com.